Good afternoon, everyone. It is 3:07 p.m., and I'll call to order this meeting of the Duval County Election Advisory Panel. We'll start with roll call, first item on the agenda. Robert Maldonado, Election Advisory Panel.
Sorry. Ray Pringle, Advisory Panel member.
Charles McWhite, Advisory Panel. Daniel Henry, Advisory Panel.
Robert Phillips, SOE Representative.
Jeff Clements, Council Research.
Thank you, everyone. We do have a quorum. Second item, the agenda is the approval of the July 2022 meeting minutes. Has everyone had a chance to review? Are there any edits or suggestions? All in favor?
Aye.
That motion passes. The next item on the agenda is our Supervisor of Elections update. So, Mr. Phillips, I know you've got a lot on your plate, so I'll turn it over to you.
All right. Thank you very much. August 23rd was the primary election. We had a 28.87% turnout. We had a recount after the election for the newly drawn Congressional District 4 on the Democratic side, and the recount came back exactly as we would have expected it to, followed by the audit, where we audited a precinct from, I believe it was Council District 9, council race, and the audit came out 100% accurate. We are preparing for the general election right now. Poll worker training is ongoing. Yesterday, was National Voter Registration Day. So in an effort to participate in that, our outreach director, Mr. Clark, who I asked him if he could come here today to give a better explanation of everything that's been going on, but he's actually teaching a class right now, so he couldn't be here. But in conjunction with this, we have reached out to several different of the local groups and used their social media for outreach. You can see we have FSCJ, UNF. We did reach out to Edward Waters, but they didn't participate. JU, the Icemen, the Shrimp, and the Jaguars. The Jaguars also, because the NFL has a nationwide voting push, I guess. And so our staff was actually at the game on Sunday and were providing voter registration, and they said they put the QR code up on the website. Unfortunately, I couldn't attend because my daughter was getting married that day, so I couldn't go to that. I could have been in the club seats, but no. anyway. We had a staff meeting this morning, and we found out that we actually got 194 new poll worker applications from these efforts. So that's good. And tomorrow night, again, the Jaguars trying to see different ways they can help us out. They're actually offering the East Club for our manager and assistant manager summit. It's going to be an opportunity for Mr. Hogan to actually get in front of almost all of them at one time, and it's going to count towards 1.5 hours towards their training. So also for the next 2 weeks, we are in a different public school every day doing voter registration drives. So all of that is ongoing while we're still prepping for the general election. Books close for this election on October the 11th, so that'll be the deadline for anyone to register. But they can still update their address, or they can update their signature at any time after that. Vote by mail ballots for UOCAVA drop this Friday, and domestic drop next Friday. Early voting this election will be 7 a.m. to 7 p.m., 12 hours a day for the full 14 days. And we did receive, I think I mentioned in our presentation last month, that we received the funding for additional express vote units. So those we're going to, hopefully, the money doesn't come in for another 2 weeks with the new fiscal year, but we're working with the vendor to get as many of those in and installed and turned around so that we can deploy them for early voting as possible. And that's basically a brief update. So with that, I'll take questions. Yes.
You mentioned the high schools. Will you go into every high school?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Every last one.
Every one of them, yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
I would like to applaud the supervisor, Mr. Hogan, and staff for diligence and expert actions in making it a question.
Thank you very much.
The other things I had at the express voting, I was in another meeting and they was talking about some of the problems that they were having with express voting.
Mm-hmm.
All of those little bugs.
This was the first, I don't want to say the unitary election wasn't a real election, you know, because they're all real elections. But one of the reasons we rolled it out in February for the special election was to try to work some of the bugs out. This was the first real full-scale test for us. for the most part, the poll worker feedback and the voter feedback has been very good. You always have some people that no matter what you do, you can't. As a matter of fact, I was returning emails on the day after the election. Some people were asking why we still were counting by machine, why we weren't counting everything by hand. You're never going to be able to please everybody. We did have some bugs with the software. When the way the system is supposed to work, when you check in the voter, if you're going to that one eVid that the machine is hooked up to, there's a little checkbox there. Well, the checkbox wasn't appearing. So if people still wanted to use the express vote, they were able to, but our rovers were able to get the technical fix in about mid-morning so that it would be more seamless. So as far as I know, all the people that wanted to use it used it. Some people, this November election will be an interesting test because it'll be the first time where we actually have a November general election with a lot of referendums on them, and you know, referendums are different when you're looking at it on a screen than if you're looking at it on the paper. So we're hoping that by deploying more of them in early voting, it's going to really cut down on the wait time for your ballot, but at the same time, it may take people a little bit longer in the actual voting booth. So, but again, this is our first general election with them. Several other counties have been using them for several years and have no issues with them. So we're pretty confident. The biggest learning curve so far seems to be just making sure our poll workers are completely comfortable with it. And like I said, most of the feedback I get is positive. So that's a good sign. Thank you. Yes, they are. You can email them. I emailed them to Jeff this morning. So you can
get copies
of them.
They'll be in your box when you get home.
And I also sent him different. We have 200, while we're talking about the November election, there's one ballot that's in there just for demonstration. But we have 205 different ballot styles for this election. This is just the sample. What's interesting is in all of the Beaches precincts, in the Jacksonville Beach precincts, they're actually going to have a two-page ballot because their individual Jacks Beach City Council had so many referendums on there, we couldn't fit them all on one page. So, yeah, it's kind of crazy.
You have any questions?
Still working on a couple, so if you have some, please feel free.
Play on the beach since we're talking about that. So when you say two pages,
four pages, FYI, actually.
It's really front and back for both.
Two cards, four pages, front and back.
Is there a reason why like the font is different when you're looking at the Jack's speech ones compared to regular elections?
Probably just so he could fit it all on there.
Okay. So are we like, when we're sending out the sample ballots for those voters, are they just going to know it's four pages based on how big the sample ballot is, or are we giving a notification in the sample ballot or on election day?
Well, every voter is going to get a sample ballot that's going to be the actual ballot that they're going to see in the polls on election day or when they go to vote early. We do have to mail a different sample ballot to the beaches with the one that everybody else is going to get. It's usually a big self-mailer that unfolds. With the Jacksonville Beach one, it's going to have to be like an insert inside an envelope with both pages in it. But they will get a sample ballot that has both pages.
That's situated already, the way that they envelope it. So is there anything on election day that will let them know that that's also going to be the case, just in case they...
There's sample ballots posted at the precinct, too, to let them know there's an A and a B. And, of course, the managers are there, and the poll workers are there to let them know to make sure that they get both pages.
Okay. Yes. But do they have, like, a script or something just like, hey, don't forget?
It's not really a script, but both pages. The second page is all referendums. So the second page is basically all Jacksonville Beach referendums and issues. So, yeah, they will be informed of that.
I think we all remember, I can't remember a cycle, if it was either 16 or 18 when we had all the constitutional amendments from this CRC.
Yeah, I remember that. That was, I think that was before Mr. Hogan, because I think Mr. Holland was still there, so we had that.
I just remember how people...
it was two pages, and it was, yeah.
People just didn't look at the back.
Yeah.
They just didn't.
And some people skipped the entire second page altogether, just didn't want it.
So that's why I was like, not only just by giving the ballot to people, are we actually letting them know that there are two pages so that way there's no confusion?
Yeah. Yes. When they go to check in to vote, they'll be told there's two pages.
Second thing that happens to the beach, we already talked about it. On election day, I forgot which precinct number it was, but...
Benny Furlong?
Yes, Benny Furlong, where the precinct manager didn't customarily go the day before, so the precinct didn't open until like an hour and a half.
Former precinct manager?
Good question. So for everyone's benefit, do you want to tell them what happened?
Not especially, but since you brought it up. Yeah, we had one precinct that opened late, Benny Furlong. The equipment was there. The equipment was delivered. One of the things we ask of all of our managers is to at least, even if you don't set up on Monday night, to go by and check your equipment, make sure you know where it is, make sure you know how to get in. And this one neglected to do that. So they didn't open until about 7:45, which I consider as... unconscionable, because in my 32 years, it's never happened before. And that's like the one thing that, you know, you absolutely positively never want to happen. So that manager did get replaced. And we're taking steps. That was a city facility. So we're working with the administration. The administration's always been very good about anything we've asked for, anything we've needed. We already had keys, but the problem is it would be as if the city hall was unlocked, but this room was locked and the equipment was in this room. So they were able to get in the building, they just not get into the room where the equipment had been moved to. And again, that could have all been avoided by checking it on Monday evening. So we are doing different things to make sure that in case that were to happen again, we would be able to open at 7 even so. But we are working with the administration to make sure that we have a person either on call or on site at all city locales and facilities for opening on election morning.
And in situations like that, are you like ready, knock on wood, it doesn't happen again, but always prepared for like worst case scenarios. Is your office or general counsel prepared for like some campaign or political party, like trying to file that particular precinct extra time for people to be able to vote?
That wouldn't happen because there's no machination or anything in place for any one precinct to stay open later than any other. What happened, the only thing that's happened like that previously was in, I believe it was 2004. I'm not exactly sure of the year, but Broward County had several precincts. It may have been 2004, it may have been 2006. But Broward County had several precincts that did not open until around 9, 10, maybe 11 a.m. And that was the there was a lot of groups down there that were saying you need to keep the polls open in these precincts. You can't do it in any one precinct. If it was done, it has to be done statewide, and it has to be called by the governor. So if these same groups were to, you know, petition that, they would have to, they couldn't take it to Mr. Hogan or the mayor. They would have to take it to the governor, and the governor would have to do it for the entire state. He wouldn't do it. He couldn't do it just for one county or one precinct.
So what if they, like, tried to go to circuit court to do it?
Same thing. It would be a court that would say. But, like I said, the precedent is if it's because of equal protection, if you keep it open in one location, you have to do it everywhere. Happened the only other time something like that happened, I believe it may have been 2012 when the governor ordered the early voting sites to stay open an additional couple hours.
Yes, Scott did it.
Wouldn't have been Scott.
I gave him too much credit. There was another precinct in District 9, I forgot which, I think it was 901, that lost power for an hour because JEA crews were working on something. What normally happens if that, something like that happens? Like, can they still operate without power with the EVIDs and stuff?
Or? Yeah, the good news is now that we have EVID edges in every precinct, the EVID Edge is battery powered. The DS200 is battery powered. The Express Vote is battery powered. So yeah, there's no operational. Before, when we didn't have edges everywhere, if there was a power outage, they might have to get through to us on the phone. We would get a rover over there who would have a generator or an inverter in their car, which we still do. The rovers still have inverters that they carry in their car. So if there's a power outage, we can send them there, and they can run up to four just off their car off their car engine, till we get a generator there, and then until JEA gets power restored. But in my understanding, in this case, I don't think there was any interruption at all because the EVID just keeps now that we have EVIDs in every precinct, they just keep rolling. So now we will send them lights and things like that if there is a power outage for any extended period of time. I think there were several precincts that probably lost power for just 15, 20 minutes because of afternoon thunderstorms and things like that, but nothing that disrupted any voting.
This was like the first time since redistricting where you had some precincts that were either combined or changes, because we went from the 199 to 186. I think at our last meeting you had said that you were going to have people outside on election day to let them know that there were a change.
Special assignments.
Yeah. So how did that go? Like, were they for the 7-7 or for?
They will be there again for the following for the upcoming election. They'll be there, and I believe there's about 26 people because we actually go back to the previous election. So even if something had moved since November, since the November 2020, if it was a polling location in the last November election and it's not now, we will still send somebody there. They don't get much activity, but they're there. I believe we talked about the fact that we were going to start using the QR codes that they could look, they could scan a piece of paper on their cell phone that would tell them where to go. There was one of the special assignments. I forget what precinct that we're at, but they had the paper handouts, but they actually ran out. So we know that people did go by there to see them. We will put someone at Gateway too for early voting during the 7-7. 14 days of early voting at Gateway. Somebody will sit at the old location at Gateway to direct them to Joseph Lee Center. So, And that's not something that's statutorily required. That's just something that we've been doing for a long
time. Appreciate that. Someone sent me a picture of like Joseph E. Lee where it looked like a portion of like the roof line was like exposed.
Yeah, I got that report, and I don't really know where it came from because A, Joseph Lee is a city site and it's maintained by the city. I think it just went through a remodel. And we didn't get any actual complaints from voters or any of the staff that were there. So I don't think it was much of an issue.
All right, finishing up. There's been a question I've seen reported in the news regarding candidate petitions for 2023 candidates. The SOE has been saying that regardless of whether or not it's a redistricting year, candidates have to get their petitions within their district, but there's an old circuit case in which it says the opposite, and what the city argued was the opposite, where they could get it from any voter. So can you kind of explain why there's a discrepancy? Because I know it kind of came up in the redistricting case.
There was the initial reason for was from discussions with OGC. Once the city council lines were voted on and enacted, some of the attorneys believed that that would mean that the year of apportionment had ended. And so, which logically makes sense, because the reason you're giving voters the opportunity to get them anywhere is because you don't know what that boundary definition is going to be. If I live in Ocean Way and I'm running for District 2, but then the line comes down my street and now I'm in District 7 and I got all my petitions in District 2, you wouldn't disqualify me, you know, because I got them in the wrong spot, because I didn't know what that boundary would be. Well, the opinion was based on once city council has defined those lines and they voted on them, well, then now you know what they're going to be, so you should go ahead and get those lines from within that district. And like I said, common sense, logically that makes sense. But then there's other opinions. There was other opinions in general counsel that said, no, it's still considered a year of apportionment until the next election. And so we just kind of split the baby and said, these are your two options. You can either get this number, which is the number that's required by the district based on the last general election, or which would be the larger number, or you could get the number based on the total number of districts divided by the total number of registered voters divided by 14. You could get that number. If you get the larger of the two numbers, then you're going to be okay regardless. We would still qualify them, but it's basically to protect them in case someone were to try and bring a court case and get them. Let's say you and I were running against each other, and I got all mine from within the district, and I got the higher number, and you got the lower number. Mm-hmm. And I tried to file a case to disqualify you. Well, even though it's in previous, you know, case law and precedent that your number would be okay, you don't know how a judge would decide to get you thrown off the ballot. So if you get the larger of the two numbers, you know you're going to be okay.
But why did the opinion of the office change from...
It never really formally changed. It was because we're still, like I said, we're still telling them you would want to get the larger number of the two.
But were you guys saying that consistently, or is that opinion change from when a candidate?
I think they were pretty consistent with that.
So all candidates, regardless of what time they asked this year, gotten the same answer that you gave us.
Yeah, because they're not actually qualifying until January.
Yeah, yeah.
Of next year.
Yeah, but so they can get their petitions in.
They could, if I was a candidate, I would be outside of an early voting site in 3 or 4 weeks, and I would get all my petitions in a day.
Yeah, the reason why I was asking that, because I had heard that, but to your logic, even with the state legislative lines, that was... Even though it was passed in January, or was it? That was one of the first things that they passed.
Well, that's a little, because then you have the lines are
the legislative lines. I'm not going to talk about Congress.
Right. The lines are just. I think that was April, and then qualifying's in June.
Right, but people were...
So you have a lot shorter compressed period of time.
Right, but people were getting their... Candidates were getting their petitions signed regardless of wherever you live between January to when the deadline was. Some people qualified really early. They were good. They were done before even session ended. Some people took them a little bit later. So that's why I was like, I just wasn't sure why we would look at that differently than city council that was kind of going around the same time of their map configuration.
That's true. But remember, the city council is the next time they run on those city council lines is almost a year later.
Sure. All right. Last question. On the redistricting case, because I know they just had their hearing earlier this week, there was reporting that General Counsel's office said that depending on how the way the judge ruled, whether on the 29th or if she has another hearing, and for instance, the court orders the city to draw the maps and the city have a shade meeting to decide whether or not they would. I was curious. Is the supervisor part of that conversation, since ultimately you guys are really what council is going to rely on as to whether or not you have enough time to do it?
The only thing they consult us with is when they would need it by. And I think that we're on record for saying there's a date in early December that would be like the drop dead date.
So that's still the case. So if a court ordered the city to redraw the maps, city decides not to appeal it. I'm not holding my breath. But let's say the city decides not to appeal it and redraws the map. As long as the maps and the new precincts are done before December, that December date that you said, then March election in 23 will go off.
I hesitate to say that because, again, it's pending litigation, and so I don't want anything that I might say on the record here to be used by either side. but I know when we've discussed with General Counsel, that was one of the questions they had asked us. And there's a certain amount of time that you have to make sure that the lines are right and that you can notify, regardless of your questions about candidates, you have to have in time to make sure the lines are right and that you can notify the voters of it. There was a case just this election in Broward County where they had one mistake in their GIS and it caused like several thousand people to get the wrong ballot. So we always want to make sure that we have enough time to double check, triple check, you know, and make sure. I've gotten in trouble for saying this before, but whatever a judge says do, you have to do.
And this is kind of like, I don't know what the right word to use, but just optically. I know this is an example for 101. I saw the example for 106 that has the congressional race. Is there a reason why you guys were okay with having, like, when a congressional race is here, it pushes everything down, so the sheriff's race goes all the way down to this weird corner that someone may miss, as opposed to just trying to move all the races so that way it gets to a higher placement?
Well, there's a uniform ballot order that says your federal races have to come first.
No, so, that I get.
Yeah, so you if you have a congressional race, you have to have it. Like this one that I'm looking at, yeah, it's one, so sheriff happens to be the next one down. What you're talking about happened in 2018, but their problem was that was in Broward County where they had the header of the race down at the bottom, but then the actual ovals for the races for people to vote on in a second column.
That's not what I'm saying.
Yeah. No, I'm just saying it's basically just placement to try to lay everything. We would never do anything like that. It's just trying to get – because somebody's going to be on the bottom regardless.
But
so we're just trying to – we try to lay it out as evenly as possible.
But even for this ballot, discounting Beach, even for this ballot, the only two races that are not on it or could be on it in a different ballot style is a state house race and a congressional race. And it seems like there's plenty of room in the third column where the Supreme Court justices are. So I just was curious as to why, instead of pushing all the state and federal races and the county race in one column, you just didn't move it so that way it was more symmetrical in all three. So that way there wasn't any of the races all the way at the bottom of the ballot where someone made it.
Well, still, if you were if you were to take this one and pull it up here, then that would still take another one and push it down there. I don't know if it – and then your first column would end a lot higher than the other. So I don't know if it would make a difference or not. I know what you're – I know what you're saying. Can you – is there a way to keep all of the state races, like, on one column and then maybe start the county races on another?
Not necessarily because of that, although it kind of flows to what I'm saying, but just to avoid having any races on that final box where someone – it happens. They just miss it.
I think somebody's always going to be last on a column. Yeah. If you can get around.
No, I get last on a column, but like the lax box reserve space. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. The reserve space right here.
Down there.
Yes, yeah. So. For this one it is, but if I have a congressional race, it's going to be pushed down. Because I'm looking at 106 right now, and the sheriff's races push all the way to the edge of the piece
on the
of
bottom.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know if that was a consideration or not, honestly.
How is it evaluated when you kind of consider it?
Our IT director does the ballot layout to get everything fit on there as best as possible, so it's kind of, you know, uniform throughout all the different styles. When you put the races in, it basically formulates them to – it just plugs everything in into a certain column and font size to make sure everything fits. So it's more of a programmatic thing, I think.
But you have the ability to edit like you did with the Jack Speech races where you had to change the font.
Yes. So I'm saying I think he just got as many things as he could fit on one column and then moved on to the second column.
Well, can I just say for the record, that may not necessarily be the best voter experience.
Okay.
I just say that because, like, if you're looking at a ballot and it's all the way at the bottom of a piece of paper right on the edge.
I see what you're saying. Yeah.
There's no gap. It's like the bubble is, like, right there and there's less than a centimeter's difference.
Well, actually, this is not – these have been doctored to remove all the timing marks and any other kind of – identifying marks. So the actual ballot would have more space on it.
So how much space will be between?
You would still have the bottom. You would still have the timing marks that go all the way around the ballot,
right,
that go around all four corners, and you would still have some margin space on the bottom. So it's not like it's going to be like right there pinned on the very bottom of the page.
So there's no division of elections rule that kind of outlines how much space should be between the last race on a ballot and the edge of the piece of paper?
I don't think so, no. I would have to look at the uniform ballot rule, but I don't think it goes into that. But that is what we follow the uniform ballot rule as far as ballot placement and race placement and things like that.
I have a couple questions, Mr. Phillips, that are borderline old business, but I'll try to run through them quickly. First, I was wondering if you could provide an update on the issue we talked about last meeting with SB 90 and the 34,000 voters that, you know, were sent those notices.
I could run probably won't really know how many people responded to that until we get through the next election. Had the same kind of inquiry from the media. The only way I know to really tell how many people responded to that is we take the number of people that we sent the notice to, and then we run another query that says how many people still need those same identifiers from that subset, and then the delta would be, you know, the number of people who responded, which I would like to know just for personal information, too.
So maybe after, probably not for next meeting, but the meeting after that.
Should know by the meeting after November.
Yeah. Okay.
Because I'm surprised you didn't ask about this. We're already planning on laying out the mailer that'll go out right after the November election to let voters know they have to re-up for their vote by mail for next year.
I would have asked eventually.
My second question is, and I just always like to kind of ask for update on voter registration and how that's going. Have you seen any upticks or is it pretty steady?
Yeah, like yesterday being National Voter Registration Day, I don't think we're going to get a huge uptick in that number. We did see a very slight increase in the number of registered voters we had from mid-year this year to book closing for August. November, it'll be, again, the November elections are always, you know, a little more interesting. So I'm planning on, let me see, what are we at right now? Okay, the current number of registered voters we have is 652,966, which is just a hair under 653,000. I was, for my budget numbers for the upcoming general election, I was around 660,000. So, but once books close in October, I can send out an email to Jeff and he can update everybody on, you know, how many new voter registrations have increased.
Yeah, I think that would be great, and can include that in our reports as well. My next question just has to do with poll workers. I know you mentioned that you got a large number of applications due to the outreach efforts. Is that something you can turn around quickly for this November election or next spring's election?
We definitely will. Each one of the persons who expressed interest received an email back from us letting them know how to register for a poll worker class and how to sign up for a class. We were actually mentioning in the meeting this morning that since we had so many new interests, if we had to add more classes, we have time to do that. So we definitely would try to get as many in as possible for the November election. And that's a statewide, nationwide issue, is a scarcity of poll workers.
Yeah, I've seen some reports and stories of SOEs struggling to fill those roles. So it's good to get that level of interest and hopefully some ones that'll stick around. My final question has to do with the express votes. I know you said that, you know, you're probably not going to get the money in time, but you might be working something out. How many do you foresee additional on top of what you already have already? How many are you hoping to get prior to November election?
We were ordering 200. That would give us the ability to put 10 in each early voting site.
Are you hoping to get all 200 of those?
Yes. Hoping to. Yeah. The only problem is the actual, as a matter of fact, while I was sitting here, I got a text that the contract is ready for Mr. Hogan to sign. That's all they need. They basically know that we won't have the money until October, but once we get the signed contract return, they can work on a shipping date. So it's just the logistics of the machines getting in, the acceptance testing done, getting the programming, the preparation done in time to turn them around for early voting, because the logic and accuracy test is October 14th. Early voting loadout is the week after that, and then early voting begins the week after that. So we really only have about 20 days. But we'll get as many in. We'd even said even if we don't get all 200 in, we could get out as many as we could.
Yeah. And I've personally used them in the last two, and I think they're great. Any other questions for Mr. Phillips before we move on?
You always say something that reminds me.
Great.
Another question. I'll start with the easy one. Is the pay for poll workers at $12 an hour or higher?
It depends. The pay for team leaders, I believe, went up to $15 an hour for team leaders for early voting. And then for inspectors, it is around $12 an hour. It may be $12.50 now. Now, that's not saying for our poll workers who work election day. Poll workers who work election day, let's say a an inspector take makes $225 an hour, okay? I mean, makes $225 a flat rate for the day. So that's $225. You take 3 hours of training and 12 hours at least on election day, probably an hour back and forth. So let's say they're actually working about 17 hours. So they're making about $13 an hour on election day.
What about for early voting?
Early voting, they make around $12.50. Like I said, I think they do get paid an hourly rate, and I think it's $12.50 an hour.
Is there? I can make $15 at Target.
Mm-hmm. Bucky's. I'm gonna retire and go work at Bucky's as a night manager.
Hopefully, you get like a discount for gas. But is there a reason why the scale is so low when even like the state is trying to gradually raise the rate of like state employees post past 15? Because we're going to get to 15 in 26. So
yeah, and like I said, we have the administration did give us enough money to do an increase to for poll workers, and it is kind of incremental. Up until this election cycle, we were the highest paying county in the state. Now a couple counties, I think, have passed us. I think Volusia and Monroe actually pay more than we do now. But as long as there are some groups that the money is really not an issue, right? You have most of your poll worker workforce is generally people who are retired or who have the time. They appreciate the $12, $13 an hour. But yeah, it is a consistent problem moving forward. We are going to have to continue to ask for funds to continue to increase their pay.
But
no, go ahead.
Because I know Mr. Hogan has increased their pay the last couple years.
But that's
an incremental process. You can't really make a huge jump all at once.
It's a double-edged sword because it's not necessarily as important to someone that's like older or retired. Then you have a concentrated workforce that's within a very small age group.
Oh, that's absolutely true. But then what you see from other groups is they take a day off to do the work. Don't have because if they're not in that retire, they're the only people who basically have the time would be retirees and students. But they're not going to fill the entire workforce.
Or someone that doesn't have a job.
Yeah. In which case, $13 now is still pretty good if they don't have a job. But we don't want people who want to do it just as a jobs program because that's not going to be sustainable for them either. That's only one day a week. I mean, one day, maybe 3 days a year, once every 4 years.
Isn't that kind of regressive? You get paid less because you have a short-term job and you're doing a public good. Like I've usually seen when like you have short-term jobs, they have to inflate the hourly rate in order to entice people to want to apply for the job.
I guess what I'm saying is it's more a person can't depend on that as an income to be a poll worker.
Yeah. But some people like have a value in terms of how much their time is worth. I mean, especially in this workforce market, we're at 2% unemployment in this state. It's competitive to try to get employees, and I get it, they're short-term workers. They're only really here for like a 3-week period, plus the training. But I just want the SOE to kind of plan for the future because when I first started on this panel and we did like this analysis on the poll workers, the majority of it was like plus 70.
Right. And that number, I'm glad to say that number has gone down significantly. The median age of poll workers has gone down. And trust me, I know what you're saying, and it's something that we are continuing to talk about. We talk about paying them an additional stipend, maybe paying some poll workers an additional amount of money if we're having a hard time recruiting poll workers in a certain area, right? So if I have some poll workers who don't want to drive all the way to the beach, I might have to pay them a little more money in this environment, especially with gas prices the way they are, to make that drive. I may be able to pay them a little bit more if they're willing to commit more of their time to definitely show up on Monday and make sure everything is, But I guess what I'm saying is I can't do it all in one budget cycle. We have increased their pay for the last 2 years. What we have for this year is set for the next up until we get to May. The amount of money we have budgeted for this year is their pay for November, March, and the May election. And we can look at it again as a further increase. And if you guys want to lobby the council to definitely give us the money, that would be helpful.
I mean, but this is kind of important. We just talked about how there's a nationwide shortage of people willing to be workers. And I just think if they're doing this type of work, frankly, even more so now at their own personal safety, because a lot of people, unfortunately, have a very negative connotation towards poll workers or people that work in elections, then I think they should be compensated for the work.
I agree with you. I'm 100% on your side with this.
Sorry, you had a...
Yeah. Mr. Pringle, yeah.
the conversation is going to something that I think is important. I've been a poll worker in the past, and the problems I see is cost of living has gone up tremendously, yet I hear we have to have poll workers. The poll workers we have is going down. Well, I understand why it's going down, because no one is remunerating them for even the cost of what they do. I mean, and I hear, well, you know, they're retirees, so they would love $13. I'd take the $13 and throw it in the trash. That's crazy. Just because you're older don't mean that you don't deserve the right pay. And I'm older, so I can talk like that. and it kind of raises my ire a little bit. And you made a statement that says you can't do a jump in price. I've seen people doing jumps in prices, just like the workers that with the trains and the truckers. They just got it. There's things that I think we need to be compensated. You look at the gas price, your vehicles, everything has gone crazy, and yet $12.50 is pretty good. I don't think $12.50 is very good at all. As a poll worker, there's a lot of times that they really don't care much about you when you're there, because, well, who are you for? And I'm sitting there not for anybody. I'm just a poll worker. And so I think that maybe we better take a look at to do the job they're.
Yeah, and I definitely.
A wonderful job there. I mean, these folks are doing a great job, and I appreciate it. I sure do, because I know what they're going through.
And I definitely didn't mean to come off as flippant, because I work with them every day, and I know what a good job they do. And they do. They come in, like I said, they have to come in for 3 hours of training, and they drive out to Imeson, and they drive to their polling location. And, you know, the last couple of elections, we have built in an increase for them. And that is going to be part of our ongoing recruiting efforts. We're going to have to continue to pay more for them.
Well, maybe if you might not just the hourly wage, but give them a travel voucher also that would compensate for the expenses that they're doing. I don't know if they're fed. I know that food when I was at the banks didn't have to worry about eating, because those country folks, they really fed you good. But I think that we could look at get people when you're working on a job. If you have to travel, you get mileage. And so why can't we give the poll workers mileage for the drive they're doing?
And again, those are all things we can look at. And like I said, Mr. Hogan is interested in looking for ways we can pay them maybe additional stipends, maybe not mileage, but just like a flat rate, instead of, you know, them having to record their mileage at, I think it's 57 cents a mile or something like that now, just give them an extra $25 or an extra $30, depending on how far they have to go. All of those are definitely things we can, you know, explore. I guess what I was trying to get at is the amount of money that the city has allocated to us for this year included a slight increase, but not a huge increase. And so with our budget being final for this upcoming year, 22-23, we won't be able to address it again until next February, once we start the budget process again.
Well, I definitely understand about this year, but this upcoming year, somebody needs to, and I don't mind getting involved in it too, and letting whoever I need to know, definitely need to.
And that's one of the reasons why we're working with these other groups to do like poll worker appreciation night, you know, with the, I know it's not something that would interest all of them, but one of the things that the Icemen did when they were helping us to recruit poll workers is, in addition to what we paid them, they gave them like a $100 voucher for either tickets or gift shop purchases or things like that if you signed up through them. And I think the Jumbo Shrimp are doing the same thing. So we're trying to work with different groups to try to incentivize that where it might not actually cost us as much. One of the problems is we actually run into legal issues because with this thing we had with the Jaguars, they wanted to give away tickets to our poll workers. They wanted to give them like two complimentary tickets, but we run into legal issues with the amount of money that you can gift them because they're technically city employees. They're working for the city, so you can only gift a city employee a certain amount. So we had to take the tickets off the table, you know, which would have.
I do understand.
Yeah.
But even like in the stipend stuff, I mean, one of the things I always think about, if any of us are ever lucky of ever getting a bonus at some point in their career, is that that gets taxed differently. So by giving a stipend, you almost have to factor in the fact that they're getting a higher tax rate for that stipend that they do receive. So I'm just curious, like, just because they're temporary employees, just because they're there for 3 weeks, I just don't think we should look at them in the sense of, oh, then we don't have to do as much.
That if that's how I came across with it, that's not what I meant. What I meant is the fact that we only have them for a short period of time. If you are someone who is going to be a poll worker, you could not look at that as your primary source of income.
But I at least has been my experience with some of the other city boards that I sit on. I mean, Inspector General being one. If a constitutional officer asks for more money for their budget, I don't see a lot of situations where the administration just says no. So I'm just curious to see if the will is there. I know you can't speak for this for Supervisor Hogan, but do you think the will is there to make that effort next time around so that way you don't have to resort to having to, although it's great to be able to go to the sports teams, get them to incentivize them to help you out. But I want you to get to the point where you're fending off people wanting to get these jobs.
I would love to be in that position, but I don't think that's never going to happen.
I know that.
No matter how much you offer them. Is his will there? Absolutely. Because he wants me to find a way with this current budget we have to pay them more coming up. So yes, but also the next budget will be for another supervisor. That other supervisor's priorities might not be in the same spot. I can't really speak for that.
Because they have that weird month period in which a new supervisor gets sworn in and the budget gets announced, right? Or is the budget basically final at that point regardless of that?
Well, and it, you know, it's, I don't want to get into the whole budget process here, but they do, you know, there are plenty of times they tell you no when you ask for things, and you have to prioritize what your ask is. So it's definitely not a blank checkbook when you go to the city for a budget request, especially when they have, you know, other departments that are doing the same thing. they, like I said, they have always been very supportive of us, and they've given us what we've asked for so far, which has, I don't want to get away from that, we have increased their salary twice over the last couple of election cycles. Each election, we've given them a little bit more money. And again, when you're talking about adding them, you know, adding another $25 to them, that might not sound much for one worker, but when you're adding $25 to, you know, 2,000 workers, the number gets big quickly in what you're asking for, especially when you're talking about adding hourly rates to the early voting for how many hours a day they work and how many, you know, workers they are and all that. So the number for early, really the biggest cost driver for elections in the last several years has been early voting and the poll worker pay. That is one of the biggest numbers of our, that's one of our biggest big item, you know, big ticket items. And so, yeah, we do have to justify that, though, when it goes forward. And it is harder getting qualified people to help work, you know. But it's something that, it's, like I said, it's a consistent issue that we're constantly thinking about and dealing with, and we're always looking at different ways to address it, whether it's through outside help or just continuing to pay them more.
100%.
And I think, you know, maybe, Jeff, you could help us moving forward and reminding us to get that on the agenda for, I guess, the first meeting of next year. So maybe we can figure out a way that we could more formally support, you know, an increase. And
well, the budget process will begin in February. And then our first department request is generally due in May. And then a new supervisor would take office in July. And then our presentation to finance is usually August.
So. Who do we lobby?
City Council.
I think we could just submit a letter from the chair, you know, with the panel's approval. And if you have some more specifics, you could provide at future meetings. I don't see any reason, you know, we can.
Well, there's a caveat to that, though. Send something that says we support X, and the supervisor submits something that says he supports something that's substantially less. We all know which side the city council is going to look at and say, well, the supervisor said you only need that, so thank you so much, but no thank you. So I think we also have to evaluate that as well when we kind of make the.
Sure, yeah.
I'm not prejudging what Supervisor Hogan will say. I'm just going off of history.
No, I'm telling you from discussions that I've had with him lately, he wants to pay poll workers more.
Can you give us the documentation as to what that scale, that new scale will be? Because I don't know what.
What do you mean? What it will be? Like what he wants to pay them? Or
well, you said a new this budget cycle it's going up, but I don't think you actually said what it's going up to.
Oh, what it is right now?
Yeah,
the current scale. It's on our website.
Oh, okay. So what's on your website is what is applying correct. For the next bit?
Correct.
Okay.
Any other questions? Mr. Phillips. Okay. If not, we'll move on to old business. I see an item here to discuss express vote equipment purchasing. I know we've kind of been over that. Jeff, was that just put on just so we reminded to chat about it? Okay.
What happened in the budget?
That got approved.
Great. I have one item of old business. I, as chair, was supposed to write a letter to the mayor's office about the vacancies on our board. I have admittedly neglected to do that, but I will have a draft by week's end for the panel's review. Other piece of old business is elections for the panel. I know we like to try to do those once a year to give everyone else an opportunity to serve as chair or vice chair. So I'm not sure if we want to set those for the November meeting. And then that way in 2023, the new president and, or excuse me, the new chair and vice chair can start at that first meeting in 2023. That's all I have for old business. New business, Moving on, looks like we want to discuss the meeting calendar for next year. So, and Jeff, I don't know if you have this information handy, but I can't recall months we've dated, or months or dates from old off year election. Is this a quarterly or
required to meet at least quarterly?
Okay.
And generally, you've done it based on the election calendar and having meetings just before and just after elections to, and then if there are no elections, maybe just a quarterly meeting somewhere in the long stretch without.
Well, we have two elections in 23.
Yeah. I'm not sure.
Counting any random special.
I guess we can work around those to try to set our, I mean, do we want to try to set the meeting dates today for next year? Does everyone have calendars and?
Looking at the November meeting, I know November's kind of tricky because the 16th is actually the week after the November election. So the election won't actually be certified by then. Does that matter to y'all? The only thing I could see is if something happens and I'm not able to come on the 16th, I don't know if it'd be possible to move it to the 23rd, but then the 24th is Thanksgiving, so a lot of people would be unavailable that whole week probably. So I mean, I guess we could just keep it the 16th, and then if something happens, I could just let Jeff know.
I agree.
I don't know if it matters to y'all or not that the election won't be completely finished by then or not.
No recounts.
Oh, no. I mean, just your 10-day UOCAVA ballots won't be back anyway. Not until Friday.
You'll be able to provide some updates, though. Right?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. I didn't know if it mattered to y'all. It doesn't matter to me.
So with that one on the 16th, we would then have December off. What are the 2023 election dates? I just
Tuesdays in March are the 7th, 14th, 21st, and
28th. Is it possible to meet before the March election, just in case? About the preparations for that, or if we have some kind of change in all the maps.
Yeah, I was going to suggest either January or February. February gives us 2 months off, which I think is kind of what we're at right now. So I think that would be February 15th.
Wednesday is the 15th, yeah.
How about, let's see. Do we want to do one in March, or is that too much? Yeah. Then, yeah, that was going to be my next suggestion. April 19th is the third Wednesday in April, and that will give you some time to. That's the third Wednesday in April. Then I was thinking one in the summer and one in the fall, unless there's a need to do more.
basically for next year, you'll have March and May, then you'll have a new supervisor coming in July. Then the next thing on the calendar would be the presidential preference primary in March of 2024.
Do we want to do, how about August? And that gives the new SOE some time to get, you know, his feet under him and say February, April, August, August 16th. And maybe one more in October or November. Say November 15th. Then we have February 15th.
Year-end report next year, too.
Sorry?
They got to do a year-end report next year, too.
Those happen in the summer.
Summer, okay.
Yeah. By June.
Okay.
That at the April meeting.
Okay.
So we'll have February 15th, 2023, April 19th, 2023, August 16th, 2023, and November 15th, 2023. Good for everyone? Does that work? And Jeff, you'll make sure those get noticed and everything.
Sure. Absolutely.
Is there any other new business?
I did have one question, though. Based on the last law that was passed in the legislature regarding challenges that people may have to VBM ballots, have you guys like established what the process will be for that? Is
there is an observation period once we begin canvassing? There is an observation period every morning. They basically have to give us 48 hours notice and make an appointment with me. 30 minutes. Whatever ballot materials they want to look at. So far, we have not had any that have challenged what our staff has either accepted or rejected.
Wait, so just make sure I understand. So if I, let's say I want to challenge someone's ballot, I have to contact you, give you 48 hours, then I show up between 8 and 8:30.
Well, you're talking about two different things.
Yeah, well, that, I was asking about the...
Okay. If there is a specific voter you want to challenge, mm-hmm. let's just say that I'm challenging you,
okay,
then you need to come down to our office and file a challenge for that voter, and... you have to give a reason why you believe that voter should be challenged. And then that voter is notified that you've challenged them. When they go to vote, the poll worker will have something in their paperwork, because when they go to show up, it's going to make them vote a provisional ballot. So they would have to give that voter, you know, this is why you have to vote a provisional, because Robert. The other thing you're talking about is... the availability of election documents. That's when a member of a designee from a political party, committee, or candidate can come in and review the voting documents, which are either the vote-by-mail certificates, the cures, things like that. So what that is, they can that is when they need to make an appointment with us to come in, because we have to make sure everything's available for them to see. And we will give them 30 minutes at the beginning of the day before we begin the canvassing process. Because once you open the ballots, they are no longer eligible to be challenged. So if we have 50,000 ballots that come back that we're ready to open once we begin processing, once we begin canvassing, then if somebody were to come in, they could randomly go through those. What has happened previously, is they've randomly gone through those and selected some to see if they agree it would be a ballot that we accepted. All right? So we'll pull that ballot, bring up the voter signature. This is what the staff was looking at. This is the signature on the ballot. We accepted it. If they don't think it should match, then they can file a challenge to the canvassing board for that, in which case we would immediately give the voter, send the voter a cure notification, but the canvassing board could still review it and determine whether or not the ballot was valid. That is something that has not happened yet. As in the past, every ballot that they've looked at, they've always agreed with us that it should be counted.
So back on the, if I wanted to challenge someone's eligibility to vote, are you prepared for instances where you'll see high volumes of challenges to those?
Yes.
So how are you guys prepared for that?
Basically, we had several attempts at it in the primary election. And once we let these individuals know that for each individual challenge, you have to come down and file each individual oath. It comes up again, the poll workers and that's one of the things we're going to be talking about tomorrow night in the training summit, is how to handle the voters who are challenged.
Because there were some high volumes that they saw in Orange County where that happened. And since the process is so, frankly, I believe, archaic in the way that you can challenge someone, since you have to individually notify everyone, I was just curious to see if you guys are prepared if someone does go through that level, goes down to the SOE's office and challenges 100 voters or 1,000 voters and put in the work to do that. Are you guys prepared to deal with
that situation? Yeah, well, the notification could take place when the person goes to vote. And they're still going to have to vote a provisional ballot. But the challenge, basically, if you're challenging a voter, you have to have a very good reason why you're challenging them. And with the ones we've seen, according to the statute, you're not going to make a challenge to a voter just based on their address, which are the ones that most people have been talking about. They don't still live at the same place where they said they lived. So if a voter comes in and they're like, oh, no, I don't still live there. I live here. Okay, well, then the challenge goes away anyway. You can't challenge them just based on their address.
Can you send what they can challenge them on? What basis?
Well, I mean, you could pick something, right? You're a felon. You're dead, you know, something like that. Anything that would, you know, why they are not eligible to be a registered voter in Duval County. Not really any documentation on why you would challenge somebody. Like I said, because most of these, that's the reason when I do poll worker training, I call challenges Bigfoot. Right? I know Bigfoot exists. I've just never seen him.
Bigfoot will come one day.
Is that on the record?
Record. Does exist. I've just never seen him. In 32 years of working here, challenges exist. I've just never seen one.
Well, they've never had the rights that they've had before.
Oh, yeah, they have. Yeah. Like you said, it's archaic. It's been like that forever. It's just now people are building a certain awareness of what they call those voters, right? But, again, challenging somebody who doesn't live there, they're not going to show up anyway.
Behave myself.
Think about that one.
There's no other new business, Mr. Pringle, anything? Oh, no. We can move on to public comments. I know we do have some members of the public here. Any comments anyone like to approach? Do you mind just stating your name and identifying yourself, please?
Hi, my name is Edna Knowles. I really just had a question for Mr. Phillips. I used to work with Mr. Phillips. Do you remember me? No.
Did you work at the call center?
Yeah, right. You said something about you didn't get a response from Edward Waters University.
I would have to talk to Mr. Clark, but he was the one.
and I think they did not respond in time for our deadline. He had reached out to them because it's all part of a, it was part of a coordinated media effort.
Yes.
And he didn't get a response back from them in time.
Mr. Clark.
Greg Clark. Yes.
Okay. You know what? I had one other question. You all were talking about voting and paying poll workers. Does that mean that you're now going to start paying poll watchers?
Poll watchers is not us.
It's not.
We have nothing. No, we do not recruit or distribute poll watchers. Poll watchers are people who represent either a political party, a political candidate, or a political action committee.
Okay.
So they are the antithesis of us.
Right, right, right. Okay. All right. That's all I had. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
You liked saying that word, didn't you?
I do. I use that in my training, too.
I'm sure you do. It seemed you were ready to say it.
Hello.
Hi, good afternoon. My name's Sam Coodley. I'm a resident of District 9 and also work for All Voting is Local. I was with the American Civil Liberties Union prior to that, working with the college students who were requesting having their early vote sites restored. They met with Mr. Hogan last Monday and were a little dispirited because even though they gave nearly 700 petitions to his office, he said he didn't know where they were. And then when they asked, well, how many petitions or, you know, buy-in from the presidents could we give, he said that no number of petitions or no number of support from either campus would change the mind about reopening the sites. And this was also a concern because the replacement sites for each of those campuses were among the five early voting sites in our urban core that were closed, of course, for the special elections. And Mr. Hogan made very clear that he plans to close those urban core sites again. So this is something of a concern, given that for reasons not having any blame with anyone here, but because the legislature has chosen to throw everyone off vote by mail after the November election, and our county just so happens to be one of the counties that has the most imminent election after that date, it seems as though, putting aside either campus, that there's a really high chance that many voters are going to be unaware that they need to get back on vote by mail while simultaneously not having any early voting options within the urban core. Now, Mr. Hogan said, well, they're the most oversaturated, but we talked to numerous voters in December and February at those closed early voting sites who went to multiple early voting sites, such as Monique Williamson. She drove to three different locations. She went to San Marco and went downtown, went to San Marco based on the advice of someone at the office. And then finally, she went to University Park Branch Library, and it was only because we had folks there that she knew to then go to Regency. So I would propose that you all should really consider making sure there's at least one early voting site in the urban core, because it certainly seems as if only closing early voting sites in the urban core, when we know categorically that black voters choose to vote early in person, which is part of why Duval has the highest early voting in person proportionally of any county in our state, that it is a problem that is compounded by the fact that everyone's going to be taken off vote by mail. I would add that it seems strange that your office will send out mailers to voters that don't have a vote by mail application in that mailer. If you're already sending a mailer, I don't understand why there isn't also that sort of option. And I bring it up because a lot of the voters we talk to, and I have 100 petitions from folks at Gateway and University Park Branch who attempted to vote there in December and February. We'd have given them to Mr. Hogan, but given that he said it, the petitions from the 700 folks on the campuses made no never mind, and he didn't even know where they were, it didn't seem like it would have been a good use of time. So I would just put out there that it seems like there's – a really good chance that specifically black voters in the urban core are going to have a pincer movement of voter suppression in March and May, where they'll simultaneously not have early voting sites. Like University Park Branch Library, folks had to go 6 miles to Regency or 6 miles to downtown. And we talked to senior citizens and veterans who didn't feel comfortable driving over those bridges, who had taken 2 buses for an hour. At the least, I would urge your office to do the commendable reforms you made for February that weren't there in December, such as putting up those jumbo yard signs to let voters know where they could go so that third-party groups don't need to do that themselves. Finally, I'd like to reiterate the offer to give a racial or economic analysis to your office. Now, Mr. Hogan said he has no never mind for either a racial or economic analysis, even if third parties created it and provided it. But I would also ask that you consider if simply one of those 5 urban core sites has especially high turnout, that you consider keeping it open. We were discouraged when we asked Mr. Hogan this question. He said no matter how good the turnout was in their urban core, he was determined to close all 5 of those sites. It seems as though that goes against the stated reason for the closures being an insufficiently high turnout. And I understand if you don't want to answer because there's multiple things here, but I just need to reiterate that from our perspective, there's no county in Florida more than Duval that is facing a potential, you know, like I said, pincer movement where the laws made by the state are going to be exacerbated if we choose to close the same saturated just in the urban core early voting sites again, especially once again, given that we know black voters who are predominantly in the urban core elect to vote early in person. Whether you're willing to have a vote by mail application in the mailer or look at which of those 5 sites has the highest turnout to consider keeping it open. Finally, with the Joseph Lee Center, we were notified by poll workers there about that hole. They notified us because they had mildew and mold allergies and were concerned about their health. We appreciate that the city did patch that hole, but would ask that you all work with the city to ensure that that 18-foot gaping hole does have sanitation where the inside walls are clean to make sure there isn't mold or mildew that develops that could negatively impact the health of your poll workers in the general election. And thank you all for your time.
Thank you very much. And I know the selecting of polling sites is something we've discussed on this panel, you know, going back. I don't know, Mr. Phillips, if you'd like to address any of his points.
Yeah, I'm not aware of any sites in the urban core that are closing. When he said, I wasn't in the meeting, but all of the 20 early voting sites that we have are open for the general election. All of the sites will be open again for March and May. So what 5 urban core sites were said to be closed?
The 5 that were closed for the most recent municipal election to fill Councilman Hazuri's seat, the replacement for Edward Waters, Prime Osborne, the replacement for UNF, FSCJ Deerwood, the San Marco Library, Gateway, and then University Park Branch Library. And again, in the case of Gateway and University Park Branch Library, we know that the median income in those surrounding areas is far below the median of the city. Public assistance needs are far higher in those communities. And the reception we had from Hogan was he was planning on closing those same 5 sites, to be clear, for March and May rather than this upcoming election. But given that those March and May elections will determine our next supervisor of elections, mayor, sheriff, and city council, you know, given incumbents win, likely for the next 8 years, it seems as though already determining to close those sites, regardless of if one of those sites had exceptionally high turnout, is in a way stacking the deck to reduce the influence or the accessibility of black voters.
Well, not to, I don't want to say, I wouldn't say, I wouldn't categorize Edward Waters and UNF as closing existing sites. They were only open for, I believe, one election cycle.
I meant so there are replacements.
Yeah, and so the Deerwood site was so that we would have more access for early voting in the Bartram area. University Park in San Marco will be open for the next three elections, for the November election, for the March elections, and for the May elections. The Gateway site we have no control over because that's leased by a landlord, and the landlord basically would not renew the lease and say we could still be there. It was my understanding it was going to be torn down already, but it hasn't happened yet. So Joseph Lee is the only substitute in that area for Gateway. So again, there's not. I think it's kind of mischaracterization to say we're closing five sites in the urban area because that's not happening.
So you won't close those five sites in the March and May municipal elections like they were closed in December and February.
Well, again, when you say five, Gateway you already got a replacement for. UNF is not urban core. San Marco is going to be open. University Park is going to be open. EWC, whereas it is in the urban core, it has not historically been an early voting site. I know there's always been a push to make it an early voting site, but Mr. Hogan still maintains that it doesn't meet the statutory requirement to be an early voting site.
Well, the Shell Suite Center actually does, and he conceded in our meeting that it is in fact owned by the city and would qualify as such. But separate from the colleges, the replacements were both closed, Prime Osborne and FSCJ Deerwood. I apologize for interrupting.
Yeah, no problem. No, I'm finished.
No, that's what I was about to say. just make sure you guys go.
But so just to be clear, the University Park Branch Library will be open in March and May next year.
Yes.
Okay.
And then, correct.
Will Prime Osborne?
Prime Osborne probably will not because they already have events going on.
But about the Joseph Lee Center?
Joseph Lee Center will be.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
I don't know.
The question was, what's going to replace Prime Osborne?
Yeah, I'm not sure right now. Okay. Possibly, we're actually talking about using the stadium because that would be the only – they want to do something like that, and obviously it's never available in the fall. But for a spring election, it might be available. But that's just preliminary. That's too soon to write down yet.
Any other public comments? Not. Our next meeting is Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. And I will adjourn this meeting at 4:35 p.m. Thank you, everyone.